jerked sideways and the glass pane behind it shattered, and the shards rained down like ice in winter. He went straight for the bank of filing cabinets. The lights were off, and the office was hot and dark, and he had to peer close to read the labels. It was an odd filing system. It was arranged partly in date order and partly by the alphabet. That was going to be a minor problem. He found a cabinet marked B and jammed the tip of the screwdriver into the keyhole and hammered it in with the heel of his hand, turned it sharp and hard and broke the lock, pulled the drawer and raked through the files with his fingers. The files all had tiny labels encased in plastic tabs, arranged so they made a neat diagonal from left to right. The labels were all typed with words starting with B. But the contents of the files were way too recent. Nothing more than 4 years old. He stepped 2 paces sideways and skipped the next B drawer and went to the next but one. The air was hot and still, and the bell was ringing loud, and the glare of the flashing blue strobe pulsed in through the windows. It was just about keeping time with his heartbeat. He broke the lock and slid the drawer, checked the labels. No good. Everything was either 6 or 7 years old. He had been inside the building 2 minutes and 30 seconds. He could hear a distant siren under the noise of the bell. He stepped sideways again and attacked the next B drawer. He checked the dates on the tabs and walked his fingers backward. 2 minutes and 50 seconds. The bell seemed louder and the strobe seemed brighter. The siren was closer. He found what he was looking for 3/4 of the way back through the drawer. It was a 2-inch-thick collection of paperwork in a heavy paper sling. He lifted the whole thing out and tucked it under his arm, left the drawer all the way open and kicked all the others shut, ran through the secretarial pen and down the stairs, checked the street from the lobby, and when he was certain it was clear, he ducked around into the alley and straight into the VW. "Go," he said. He was a little breathless, and that surprised him.
"Where?"
Alice asked. "South," he said, "to the Red House."
"Why? What's there?"
"Everything," he said. She took off fast, and 50 yards later, Reacher saw red lights pulsing in the distance behind them. The Pecos Police Department, arriving at the courthouse just a minute too late. He smiled in the dark and turned his head in time to catch a split-second glimpse of a big sedan nosing left, 200 yards ahead of them, into the road that led down to Alice's place. It flashed through the yellow wash of a streetlight and disappeared. It looked like a police-spec Crown Victoria, plain steel wheels, and 4 VHF antennas on the back. He stared into the darkness that had swallowed it and turned his head as they passed. "Fast as you can," he said to Alice. Then he laid the captured paperwork on his knees and reached up and clicked on the dome light so he could read it. The B was for Border Patrol, and the file summarized the crimes committed by it 12 years ago and the measures taken in response. It made for unpleasant reading. The border between Mexico and Texas was very long, and for an accumulated total of about half its length, there were roads and towns near enough on the American side to make it worth guarding pretty closely. Theory was, if illegals penetrated there, they could slip away into the interior fast and easily. Other sectors had nothing to offer except 50 or 100 miles of empty, parched desert. Those sectors weren't really guarded at all. Standard practice was to ignore the border itself and conduct random vehicle sweeps behind the line by day or night, to pick the migrants up at some point during their hopeless 3 or 4 day trudge north across the wastelands. It was a practice that worked well. After the first 30 or so miles on foot through the heat, the migrants became pretty passive. Often they surrendered willingly. Often the vehicle sweeps turned into first aid mercy missions because the walkers were sick and dehydrated and exhausted because they had no food or water. They had no food or water because they had been cheated. Usually they would pay their life savings to some operator on the Mexican side who was offering them a fully accompanied one-way trip to paradise. Vans and minibuses would take them from their villages to the border, and then the guide would crouch and point across a deserted footbridge to a distant sandhill and swear that more vans and minibuses were waiting behind it, full of supplies and ready to go. The migrants would take a deep breath and sprint across, only to find nothing behind the distant sandhill. Too hopeful and too afraid to turn back, they would just blindly walk ahead into exhaustion. Sometimes there would be a vehicle waiting, but its driver would demand a separate substantial payment. The migrants had nothing left to offer, except maybe some small items of personal value. The new driver would laugh and call them worthless. Then he would take them anyway and offer to see what cash he could raise on them up ahead. He would drive off in a cloud of hot dust and never be seen again. The migrants would eventually realize they had been duped, and they would start stumbling north on foot. Then it became a simple question of endurance. The weather was key. In a hot summer, the mortality rate was very high. That was why the Border Patrol's random sweeps were often seen as mercy missions. Then that suddenly changed. For a whole year, the roving vehicles were as likely to bring sudden death as arrest or aid. At unpredictable intervals, always at night, rifles would fire, and a truck would roar in and swoop and maneuver until one lone runner was winnowed out from the pack. Then the lone runner would be hunted for a mile or so and shot down. Then the truck would disappear into the dark again, engine roaring, headlights bouncing, dust trailing, and stunned silence would descend. Sometimes it wasn't so clean. Some victims were wounded and dragged away and tortured. The corpse of one teenage boy was found tied to a cactus stump with barbed wire. He had been partially flayed. Some were burned alive, or beheaded, or mutilated. Three teenage girls were captured over a period of 4 months. Their autopsy details were gruesome. None of the survivor families made official complaints. They all shared the illegals' basic fear of involvement with bureaucracy. But stories began to circulate around the community of legal relatives and their support groups. Lawyers and rights advocates started compiling files. Eventually, the subject was broached at the appropriate level. A low-level inquiry was started. Evidence was gathered anonymously. A provable total of 17 homicides was established. Added to that was an extrapolated figure of 8 more to represent cases where bodies had never been found or where they had been buried by the survivors themselves. Young Raul Garcia's name was included in the second total. There was a map in the file. Most of the ambushes had taken place inside a pear-shaped pocket of territory enclosing maybe 100 square miles. It was marked on the map like a stain. It was centered on a long north-south axis, with the southerly bulge sitting mostly inside the Echo County line. That meant the victims had already made it 50 miles or more. By then, they would be weak and tired and in no shape to resist. Border Patrol brass launched a full-scale investigation one August, 11 months after the first vague rumors surfaced. There was one more attack at the end of that month, and then nothing, ever again. Denied an ongoing forensic basis for examination, the investigation got nowhere at all. There were preventive measures enforced, like strict accounting of ammunition and increased frequency of radio checks. But no conclusions were reached. It was a thorough job, and to their credit, the brass kept hard at it. But a retrospective investigation into a closed paramilitary world where the only witnesses denied ever having been near the border in the first place was hopeless. The matter wound down. Time passed. The homicides had stopped. The survivors were building new lives. The immigration amnesties had insulated the outrage. The tempo of investigation slowed to a halt. The files were sealed 4 years later.
So?
Alice said. Reacher butted the papers together with the heel of his hand, closed the file, pitched it behind him into the rear seat. Now I know why she lied about the ring, he said.
Why?
She didn't lie. She was telling the truth.
She said it was a fake, worth $30.
And she thought that was the truth, because some jeweler in Pecos laughed at her and told her it was a fake worth $30. And she believed him. But he was trying to rip her off, was all, trying to buy it for $30 and sell it again for $60,000. Oldest scam in the world. Exact same thing happened to some of these immigrants in the file. Their first experience of America.
The jeweler lied.
He nodded. I should have figured it before, because it's obvious. Probably the exact same guy we went to. I figured he didn't look like the Better Business Bureau's poster boy.
He didn't try to rip us off.
No, Alice, he didn't. Because you're a sharp-looking white lawyer, and I'm a big, tough-looking white guy. She was a small Mexican woman, all alone and desperate and scared. He saw an opportunity with her that he didn't see with us. Alice was quiet for a second.
So, what does it mean?
She asked. Reacher clicked off the dome light, smiled in the dark, and stretched, put his palms on the dash in front of him, and flexed his massive shoulders against the pressure. It means we're good to go, he said. It means all our ducks are in a neat little row. And it means you should drive faster, because right now we're maybe 20 minutes ahead of the bad guys, and I want to keep it that way as long as I can. She blew straight through the sleeping crossroads hamlet once again, and made the remaining 60 miles in 43 minutes, which Reacher figured was pretty good for a yellow 4-cylinder import with a bud vase next to the steering wheel. She made the turn in under the gate and braked hard and stopped at the foot of the porch steps. The porch lights were on, and the VW's dust fogged up around them in a khaki cloud. It was close to 2 o'clock in the morning. Leave it running, Reacher said. He led her up to the door, hammered hard on it, and got no reply. Tried the handle. It was unlocked. Why would it be locked? We're 60 miles from the nearest crossroads. He swung it open, and they stepped straight into the red-painted foyer. Hold your arms out, he said. He unloaded all 6 22 hunting rifles out of the rack on the wall and laid them in her arms, alternately muzzled to stock so they would balance. She staggered slightly under the weight. Go put them in the car, he said. There was the sound of footsteps overhead, then creaking from the stairs, and Bobby Greer came out of the parlor door rubbing sleep out of his eyes. He was barefoot and wearing boxers and a T-shirt and staring at the empty gun rack.
How do you think you're doing? He said.
I want the others, Reacher said. I'm commandeering your weapons. On behalf of the Echo County Sheriff. I'm a deputy, remember?
There aren't any others.
Yes, sir, R. Bobby. No self-respecting redneck like you is going to be satisfied with a bunch of 22 pop guns. Where's the heavy metal? Bobby said nothing. Don't mess with me, Bobby, Reacher said. It's way too late for that. Bobby paused, then he shrugged.
Okay,
he said. He padded barefoot across the foyer and pushed open a door that led into a small, dark space that could have been a study. He flicked on a light, and Reacher saw black and white pictures of oil wells on the walls. There was a desk and a chair and another gun rack filled with four 30-30 Winchesters, 7-shot lever-action repeaters, big, handsome weapons, oiled wood, 20-inch barrels, beautifully kept. Wyatt Earp, eat your heart out. Ammunition? Reacher asked. Bobby opened a drawer in the gun rack's pedestal, took out a cardboard box of Winchester cartridges. I've got some special loads, too, he said. Took out another box. What are they? I made them myself. Extra power. Reacher nodded. Take them all out to the car. Okay. He took the four rifles out of the rack and followed Bobby out of the house. Alice was sitting in the car. The 6.22s were piled on the seat behind her. Bobby leaned in and placed the ammunition next to them. Reacher stacked the Winchesters upright behind the passenger seat. Then he turned back to Bobby. I'm going to borrow your Jeep, he said. Bobby shrugged, barefoot on the hot dirt. Keys are in it, he said. You and your mother stay in the house now, Reacher said. Anybody seen out and about will be considered hostile. Okay. Bobby nodded, turned and walked to the foot of the steps, glanced back once and went inside the house. Reacher leaned into the VW to talk to Alice.
What are we doing?
She said. Getting ready.
For what?
For whatever comes our way.
Why do we need 10 rifles?
We don't. We need one. I don't want to give the bad guys the other 9, is all.
They're coming here?
They're about 10 minutes behind us.
So, what do we do?
We're all going out in the desert.
Is there going to be shooting?
Probably.
Is that smart? You said yourself they're good shots.
With handguns. Best way to defend against handguns is hide a long way off and shoot back with the biggest rifle you can find. She shook her head.
I can't be a part of this, Reacher. It's not right. And I've never even held a rifle.
You don't have to shoot, he said. But you have to be a witness. You have to identify exactly who comes for us. I'm relying on you. It's vital.
How will I see? It's dark out there.
We'll fix that.
It's going to rain.
That'll help us.
This is not right, she said again. The police should handle this. Or the FBI. You can't just shoot at people.
The air was heavy with storm. The breeze was blowing again, and he could smell pressure and voltage building in the sky. Rules of engagement, Alice, he said. I'll wait for an overtly hostile act before I do anything. Just like the U.S. Army. Okay?
We'll be killed.
You'll be hiding far away.
Then you'll be killed. You said it yourself. They're good at this.
They're good at walking up to somebody and shooting them in the head. What they're like out in the open in the dark against incoming rifle fire is anybody's guess.
You're crazy.
7 minutes, he said. She glanced backward at the road from the north. Then she shook her head and shoved the gear stick into first and held her foot on the clutch. He leaned in and squeezed her shoulder. Follow me close. Okay, he said. He ran down to the motor barn and got into the Greer family's Cherokee, racked the seat back, and started the engine and switched on the headlights, reversed into the yard, and straightened up and looped around the motor barn and headed straight down the dirt track into open country. Checked the mirror and saw the VW right there behind him. Looked ahead again and saw the first raindrop hit his windshield. It was as big as a silver dollar. 16. They drove in convoy for 5 fast miles through the dark. There was no moonlight, no starlight. Cloud cover was low and thick, but it held the rain to nothing more than occasional splattering drops. 10 whole seconds between each of them, maybe 6 in every minute. They exploded against the windshield into wet patches the size of saucers. Reacher swatted each of them separately with the windshield wipers. He held steady around 40 miles an hour and followed the track through the brush. It turned randomly left and right, heading basically south toward the storm. The ground was very rough. The Jeep was bouncing and jarring. The VW was struggling to keep pace behind him. Its headlights were swinging and jumping in his mirrors. 5 miles from the house, the rain was still holding, and the mesquite and the fractured limestone began to narrow the track. The terrain was changing under their wheels. They had started out across a broad desert plain that might have been cultivated grassland a century ago. Now the ground was rising slowly and shading into mesa. Rocky outcrops rose left and right in the headlight beams, channeling them roughly south and east. Taller stands of mesquite crowded in and funneled them tighter. Soon, there was nothing more than a pair of deep ruts worn through the hard pan. Ledges and sinkholes and dense patches of thorny low brush meant they had no choice but to follow them. They curved and twisted and felt like a riverbed. Then the track bumped upward and straightened and ran like a highway across a miniature limestone mesa. The stone was a raised pan as big as a football field, maybe 120 yards long and 80 wide, roughly oval in shape. There was no vegetation growing on it. Reacher swung the Jeep in a wide circle and used the headlights on bright to check the perimeter. All around the edges, the ground fell away a couple of feet into rocky soil. Stunted bushes crowded any place they could find to put their roots. He drove a second circle, wider, and he liked what he saw. The miniature mesa was as bare as a dinner plate laid on a dead lawn. He smiled to himself, timed out in his head what they needed to do, liked the answer he came up with. He drove all the way to the far end of the rock table and stopped where the track bumped down off it and disappeared onward. Alice pulled the VW alongside him. He jumped out of the Jeep and ducked down to her window. The night air was still hot, still damp. The urgent breeze was back. Big raindrops fell lazily and vertically. He felt like he could have dodged each one of them individually. Alice used a switch and buzzed the window down. "You okay?" he asked her.
"So far," she said.
"Turn it around and back it up to the edge," he said. "All the way back. Block the mouth of the track." She maneuvered the car like she was parking on a city street and ran it backward until it was centered in the mouth of the track and the rear wheels were tight against the drop. She left the front facing exactly north, the way they had come. He nosed the Jeep next to her and opened the tailgate.
"Kill the motor and the lights," he called. "Get the rifles."
She passed him the big Winchesters one at a time. He laid them sideways in the Jeep's load space. She passed him the .22s, and he pitched them away into the brush. as far as he could throw them. She passed him the two boxes of 30-30 ammunition, Winchester's own and Bobby Greer's hand loads. He laid them alongside the rifles, ducked around to the driver's door and switched the engine off. The lumpy six-cylinder idle died. Silence fell. He listened hard and scanned the northern horizon. The mesquite sighed faintly in the wind. Unseen insects buzzed and chattered. Infrequent raindrops hit his shoulders. That was all. Nothing else. Absolute blackness and silence everywhere. He came back to the tailgate and opened the ammunition boxes. They were both packed tight with cartridges standing on their firing pins, points upward. The factory shells were new and bright. Bobby's were a little scuffed, recycled brass. He took one out and held it up to the Jeep's interior light and looked hard at it. "I made them myself," Bobby had said. "Extra power." Which was logical. Why else would a jerk like Bobby hand load his own cartridges? Not for less power, that was for sure. Like, why do people tune hot rod motors? Not to make them milder than stock. It's a boy thing. So Bobby had probably packed and tamped a whole lot of extra powder into each one. Maybe 30 or 40 extra grains. And maybe he had used hotter powder than normal, which would give him a couple hundred extra foot-pounds of muzzle energy, and maybe 100 miles an hour extra velocity, and which would give him the muzzle flash from hell, and which would ruin his breech castings and warp his barrels inside a couple of weeks. But Reacher smiled and took 10 more of the shells out of the box anyway. They weren't his guns, and he had just decided muzzle flash was exactly what he was looking for. He loaded the first Winchester with a single sample of Bobby's hand loads. The second, he filled with 7 more. The third, he loaded alternately 1 stock round, 1 of Bobby's, another stock round, until it was full with 4 stock and 3 hand loads. The fourth rifle, he filled entirely with factory ammo. He laid the guns left to right in sequence across the Jeep's load space and closed the tailgate on them.
"I thought we only needed one," Alice said.
"I changed the plan," he said. He stepped around to the driver's seat and Alice climbed in beside him.
"Where are we going now?" she asked.
He started the engine and backed away from the parked VW. "Think of this mesa like a clock face," he said. "We came in at the 6 o'clock position. Right now, your car is parked at the 12, facing backward. You're going to be hiding on the rim at the 8, on foot. Your job is to fire a rifle, 1 shot, and then scoot down to the 7.
"You said I wouldn't have to shoot."
"I changed the plan," he said again.
"I told you I can't fire a rifle."
"Yes, you can. You just pull the trigger. It's easy. Don't worry about aiming or anything. All I want is the sound and the flash."
"Then what?"
"Then you scoot down to the 7 and watch. I'm going to be busy shooting. I need you to ID exactly who I'm shooting at."
"This isn't right."
"It isn't wrong, either."
"You think?"
"You ever seen Clay Allison's grave?" She rolled her eyes.
"You need to read the history books, Reacher. Clay Allison was a total psychopath. He once killed a guy bunking with him just because he snored. He was an amoral maniac, plain and simple. Nothing too noble about that."
Reacher shrugged. "Well, we can't back out now."
2 wrongs don't make a right, you know?"
"It's a choice, Alice. Either we ambush them or get ambushed by them." She shook her head.
"Great," she said.
He said nothing.
"It's dark," she said. "How will I see anything?"
"I'll take care of that."
How will I know when to fire?
You'll know. He pulled the Jeep close to the edge of the limestone table and stopped, opened the tailgate and took out the first rifle, checked his bearings and ran to the fractured rock lip and laid the gun on the ground with the butt hanging over the edge and the barrel pointing at the emptiness 20 feet in front of the distant VW. He leaned down and racked the lever. It moved precisely with a sweet, metallic slick-slick. A fine weapon. It's ready to fire, he said, and this is the 8 o'clock spot. Stay down below the lip, fire the gun, and then move to the 7. Crouch low all the way, and then watch, real careful. They might fire in your direction, but I guarantee they'll miss. Okay? She said nothing. I promise, he said. Don't worry about it.
Are you sure?
Superman couldn't hit anything with a handgun in the dark at this distance.
They might get lucky.
No, Alice. Tonight they're not going to get lucky. Believe me.
But when do I fire?
Fire when ready, he said. He watched her hide below the lip of the rock, an arm's length from her rifle. Good luck, he said. I'll see you later.
Great,
she said again. He climbed back into the Jeep and hustled it straight across the mesa to the 4 o'clock position, spun the wheel and reversed the car and backed it straight off the rock. It bumped down 2 feet and came to a shuddering stop in the undergrowth. He killed the engine and the lights, took the fourth rifle and propped it upright against the passenger door, carried the second and third with him, and climbed back onto the ledge and ran in the open to what he estimated was the 2 o'clock spot, laid the third rifle carefully on the lip of the rock, and ran the rest of the way to the parked VW, ducked inside and unscrewed the dome light, eased the driver's door back to 3 inches from closed and left it, measured 20 feet clockwise, and laid the second rifle on the ground, on the rim of the ledge, somewhere between the 12 and the 1. 12:30, maybe. No, about 12:17, to be pedantic, he thought. Then he crawled back and lay face down on the ground, tight up against the VW, with his right shoulder tucked under the little running board and the right side of his face pressed against the sidewall of the front tire. He was breathing deeply. The tires smelled like rubber. His left shoulder was out in the weather. Big, ponderous raindrops hit it at infrequent intervals. He hitched in closer and settled down to wait. 8 minutes, perhaps, he thought. Maybe 9. It was 11 minutes. They were a little slower than he expected. He saw a flash in the north and at first thought it was lightning, but then it happened again, and he saw it was headlight beams bouncing across rough terrain and catching the low gray cloud overhead. A vehicle was pitching and rolling its way through the darkness. It was heading his way, which he knew it would, because the landscape gave it no other choice but to stay on the track. Its lights flared and died as the nose rose and fell. He was sweating. The air around him was hotter than ever. He could feel pressure and electricity in the sky above. The raindrops were falling harder and a little faster. It felt like a fuse was burning, and the storm was set to explode. Not yet, he thought. Please, give me 5 minutes more. 30 seconds later, he could hear an engine, a gasoline engine, running hard, 8 cylinders. The sound rose and fell as the driven wheels gripped the dirt and then bounced and lost traction. Hard suspension, he thought. Load-carrying suspension. Bobby's pickup, probably. The one he used to hunt the armadillo. He tucked himself tighter against the underside of the VW. The engine noise grew louder. It rose and fell. The lights bounced and swerved. They lit the northern horizon with a dull glow. Then they were near enough to make out as separate twin beams spearing through the mesquite. They threw harsh shadows and flicked left and right as the vehicle turned. Then the truck burst into sight. It bounced up onto the mesa, traveling fast. The engine screamed like all four wheels were off the ground. The headlights flared high and then dipped low as it crashed back to earth. It landed slightly off course, and the lights swept the perimeter for a second before they straightened ahead. It accelerated on the flatter terrain. The engine was loud. It came on and on, straight at him. Faster and faster, 40 miles an hour, 50, 70 yards away. 50, 40. It came straight at him until the bouncing headlights washed over the stationary VW directly ahead of it. The yellow paint above Reacher's shoulder glowed impossibly bright. Then the truck jammed to a panic stop. All four wheels locked hard on the limestone grit, and there was a howl of rubber, and the truck slewed slightly left and came to rest facing 11 o'clock, maybe 30 yards in front of him. The far edge of the headlight beams washed over him. He forced himself tighter under the VW. He could smell the raindrops in the dust. Nothing happened for a second. Then the pickup driver killed his lights. They faded to weak orange filaments and died to nothing, and total darkness came back. The insects went silent. No sound at all beyond the truck engine idling against the brake. Reacher thought, did they see me? Nothing happened. Now, Alice, Reacher thought. Nothing happened. Shoot, Alice, he thought. Shoot now, for God's sake. Nothing happened. Shoot the damn gun, Alice. Just pull the damn trigger. Nothing happened. He closed his eyes and paused another whole endless second and braced himself to launch outward anyway. Opened his eyes and took a breath and started moving. Then Alice fired. There was a monstrous muzzle flash, easily 10 feet long, far away to his right, and the buzzing whine of a supersonic bullet high in the air, and a split second later an enormous barking crash clapped across the landscape. He rolled out from under the VW and reached in through the driver's door and flicked the headlights on, jumped backward into the mesquite and kept rolling, and came up into a low crouch 6 feet away to see the pickup caught perfectly in the cone of bright light. Three people in it. A driver in the cab, two figures crouching in the load bed, holding the roll bar one-handed. All three of them, with their heads turned abruptly on their shoulders, rigid and frozen and staring backward at the spot Alice had fired from. They were immobile a split second longer, and then they reacted. The driver flicked his own lights back on. The pickup and the VW glared at each other like it was a contest. Reacher was dazzled by the light, but he saw the figures in the load bed were wearing caps and blue jackets. One figure was smaller than the other. A woman, he thought. He fixed her position carefully in his mind. Shoot the women first. That was the standard counter-terrorist doctrine. The experts figured they were more fanatical. And suddenly, he knew she was the shooter. She had to be. Small hands, neat fingers. Carmen's Larson could have been built for her. She was crouched low alongside her partner on his left. They both had handguns. They both stared sideways a half second longer, and then snapped forward into the glare and leaned on the pickup's roof and started shooting at the VW's lights. Their caps said FBI on the front. He froze. What the hell? Then he relaxed. Beautiful. Fake apparel. Fake ID. A tricked-up Crown Vic. They just went to Alice's place in it, and that's how they stopped Al Eugene on Friday. They were shooting continuously. He heard the flat, dull thumps of powerful 9mm pistols firing fast. He heard spent shells clattering out onto the pickup's roof. He saw the VW's windshield explode and heard bullets punching through sheet metal and the tinkling of glass, and then the VW's lights were gone, and he could see nothing at all behind the dazzle of the pickup's own lights. He sensed the pistols turning back to where they had Alice's firing position fixed in their memories. He saw tiny, oblique muzzle flashes and heard bullets whining away from him. The left-hand gun stopped. The woman, reloading already. Only 13 shots, his subconscious mind told him. Has to be a Sig Sauer P-228, or a Browning High Power. He crawled forward to the rim of the mesa and tracked 15 feet left and found the rifle he had placed at 1217, Winchester number 2, full of Bobby Greer's handloads. He fired without aiming, and the recoil almost knocked him off his knees. A tremendous flame leapt out of the muzzle. It was like the strobe on a camera. He had no idea where the bullet went. He racked the lever, slick, slick, and hustled right toward the wrecked VW, fired again. Two huge visible flashes moving progressively counterclockwise. From the pickup's vantage point, it would look like a person traversing right to left. A smart shooter would fire ahead of the last flash and hope to hit the moving target. Deflection shooting. They went for it. He heard bullets whining off the rock near the car, heard one hit it. But by then, he was on the move in the opposite direction, clockwise again. He dropped the rifle and bent low and ran for the next one. It was there, at 2 o'clock. The third Winchester, the one with the sequenced load. The first shot was a factory bullet, worth some care. He steadied himself on the lip of the ledge and aimed into the blackness 8 feet behind the pickup's headlights and 4 feet above them. Fired once. Now they think there are 3 riflemen out here, one behind them on the left, 2 ahead on the right. There was ringing in his ears, and he couldn't see where his bullet went, but he heard the woman's voice shout a faint command, and the pickup's headlights promptly died. He fired again at the same spot with the next shell, which was a handload. The gout of flame spat out and lit up the mesa, and he jinked 5 feet right. Tracked the frozen visual target in his mind, and fired the next. The second factory bullet, neat and straight and true. He heard a sharp scream, danced one pace to his right, and fired the next handload. The muzzle flash showed him a body falling headfirst out of the pickup bed. It was caught entirely motionless in midair. One down. But the wrong one. It was too big. It was a man. Factory round next. He concentrated hard and aimed again slightly left of the place the guy had fallen from. Racked the lever. It moved a quarter inch and jammed solid on the worn cartridge case from the last handload. Then, 2 things happened. First, the pickup moved. It lurched forward and peeled away fast in a tight, desperate circle and headed back north the way it had come. Then a handgun started firing close to the VW. The woman was out of the truck. She was on foot in the dark. She was firing fast. A hail of bullets. They were missing him by 3 or 4 feet. The truck raced away. Its lights flicked on again. He tracked them in the corner of his eye. They jerked and bounced and swerved and grew smaller. Then they disappeared off the end of the mesa. The truck just thumped down off the edge of the rock table and hurtled back toward the red house. Its noise faded to nothing, and its lights dimmed to a distant glow moving on the far black horizon. The handgun stopped firing, reloading again. There was sudden total silence, total darkness. A second later, the insect chant swam back into focus. It sounded softer than usual, less frantic. He realized the rain had changed. The heavy drops had stopped, and in their place was an insistent patter of drizzle. He held his hand palm up and felt it building. It grew perceptibly harder and harder within seconds, like he was standing in a shower stall and an unseen hand was opening the faucet wider and wider. He wiped water off his forehead to keep it out of his eyes and laid the jammed rifle quietly in the dust. The dust was already wet under his fingers. It was turning to mud. He moved left, tracking back toward the hidden jeep. It was maybe 40 yards away. The rain got harder. It built and built, like there was going to be no limit to its power. It hissed and roared on the mesquite bushes all around him. Good news and bad news. The good news was, it took making noise out of the equation. He wouldn't have backed himself to move as quietly as the woman could, not through desert vegetation at night. A frame 6 feet 5 in height and 250 pounds in weight was good for a lot of things, but not for silent progress through unseen thorny plants. The noise of the rain would help him more than her. That was the good news. The bad news was, visibility was soon going to be worse than zero. They could bump into each other back to back before either of them knew the other was there. So a lever-action repeater was not going to be the weapon of choice. Too slow for a snapshot, too cumbersome to maneuver. And a Winchester throws the spent shell out of the top, not out of the side, which means in a heavy rainstorm it can let water in through the ejection port. And this was going to be a heavy rainstorm. He could sense it. It was going to try to compensate for 10 years of drought in a single night. He made it back to the jeep at the 4 o'clock position, found the fourth rifle propped against its door, full of factory shells. It was already soaked. He shook it off and aimed obliquely across the mesa toward the 11. Pulled the trigger. It fired. It still worked fine. He fired 4 more spaced shots at the 12, the 1, the 2, the 3. Fan fire. A gamble. The upside was he might get lucky and hit the woman. Downside was it would tell her he was on his own. One guy, more than one rifle. That was now an easy deduction. And it would tell her where he was. If she was counting, it would suggest to her he was waiting there with the last 2 shells still in the magazine. So he slid the gun under the jeep and waded west through the brush until he was 40 feet from the edge of the rock, pulled Alice's Heckler and Coke out of his pocket and knocked the safety off, knelt down and smeared mud over his hands and arms and face and waited for lightning to strike. Summer storms he had witnessed before in hot parts of the world always featured lightning. Gigantic thunderheads rubbed and jostled overhead, and the voltage built to an unbearable level. 5 more minutes, he guessed. Then lightning would fire in bolts or sheets, and the landscape would flash with brightness. He was in khaki clothes and had smeared khaki mud on his skin. He doubted that she had. He worked south, away from the jeep, back toward the wrecked VW, keeping 40 feet in the undergrowth. The darkness was total. The rain was building relentlessly. It built to the point where it was absolutely impossible that it could build any harder. And then it just kept on building. The limestone sinkholes were already full of water. Rain was lashing their surfaces. Small rivers were running around his feet, gurgling into bottomless crevasses all around. The noise was astonishing. The rain was roaring against the ground so hard that it was impossible to imagine a louder sound. Then it fell harder and the sound got louder. He realized the camouflage mud had rinsed straight off his skin. Impossible for it not to. Carmen's shower was like a grudging trickle in comparison. He began to worry about breathing. How could there be air to breathe with so much water? It was running down his face in solid streams and running straight into his mouth. He put his hand over his jaw and sucked air through his fingers and spat and spluttered the rainwater away. He was opposite the 2 o'clock position and 30 feet from the ledge when the lightning started. Far to the south, a ragged bolt exploded from the sky and hit the earth 5 miles away. It was pure, intense white, and shaped like a bare tree hurled upside down by a hurricane. He fell to a crouch and stared straight ahead. looking for peripheral vision, saw nothing. The thunder followed the lightning 5 seconds later, a ragged, tearing rumble. Where is she? Does she think she's smarter than she thinks I am? In which case, she'll be behind me. But he didn't turn around. Life is always about guessing and gambling, and he had her pegged as a slick operator for sure, in her world. Put her out on the street face to face with Al Eugene, and she's got the smarts to charm the birds out of the trees. But put her down all alone in open combat territory, at night, in a storm, and she's struggling. I'm good at this. She's not. She's in front of me, clinging to the edge of the mesa somewhere, scared like she's never been scared before. She's mine. The storm was moving. The second lightning strike came 3 minutes later, and a mile north and east of the first one. It was a jagged sheet that flickered insanely for 8 or 10 seconds before dying into darkness. Reacher craned upward and scanned ahead and right, saw nothing, turned and scanned left, saw the woman 70 feet away, crouched in the lee of the ledge. He could see the white writing on her cap, FBI, big letters. She was looking straight at him, and her gun was rigid in her hand, and her arm was fully extended from the shoulder. He saw the muzzle flash as she fired at him. It was a tiny, dull spark, completely overwhelmed by the storm. The storm drifted slowly north and east and pushed the leading edge of rain ahead of it. It reached the motel building and built steadily and quickly from a whisper to a patter to a hard, relentless drumming on the roof. It was a metal roof, and within 30 seconds the noise was very loud. It woke Ellie from a restless, troubled sleep. She opened her eyes wide and saw the small, dark man with hair on his arms. He was sitting very still in a chair near the bed, watching her. "Hi, kid," he said. Ellie said nothing. "Can't sleep?" Ellie looked up at the ceiling.
"Raining,"
she said.
"It's noisy."
The man nodded and checked his watch. She missed him. Impossible to tell by how much, the lightning died and plunged the world back into absolute darkness. Reacher fired once at the remembered target and listened hard. Nothing. Probably a miss. 70 feet in heavy rain, not an easy shot. Then the thunderclap came. There was a shuddering bass boom that rocked the ground and rolled slowly away. He crouched again. He had 9 bullets left. Then he threw the double bluff dice. "She'll think I'll move, so I won't." He stayed right where he was, waited for the next lightning bolt. It would tell him how good she was. An amateur would move away from him. A good pro would move closer. A really good pro would double bluff the double bluff and stay exactly where she was. By then the rain was as heavy as it was going to get. That was his guess. He had once been caught in a jungle storm in Central America and gotten wet faster than falling fully clothed into the sea. That was the hardest rain imaginable, and this was easily comparable. He was completely soaked to the skin, beyond soaked. Water was running in continuous torrents under his shirt, pouring off him, not dripping. It sluiced out of his buttonholes like jets. He was cold. The temperature had plummeted 20 or 30 degrees in less than 20 minutes. As much water was bouncing upward around him as was lashing down, the noise was unbearable. Leaves and stalks were tearing off the bushes. They were flowing and eddying away and building tiny beaver dams against every rock on the ground. The hard, hot grit had washed into slushy mud 6 inches deep. His feet were sinking in it. His gun was soaked. That's okay. A heckler and cook will fire wet. But so will a Browning or a Sig. The next lightning flash was still well to the south, but it was nearer and brighter. It was a gigantic lateral bolt that hissed and crackled across the sky. He scanned left. The woman had moved closer. She was 60 feet away from him, still tight against the mesa. Good, but not really good. She fired at him and missed by 4 feet. It was a hasty shot, and her arm was still swinging in from the south. The south? She figured I had moved away. He felt mildly insulted, and leveled his arm and fired back. The incoming thunderclap buried the sound of the shot. Probably a miss. 8 left. Then it was back to the calculations. What will she do? What will she figure I'll do? She had been wrong the last time. So this time she'll gamble. She'll guess I'll move in closer, so she'll move in closer too. She'll go for the killing shot immediately. He stayed in a crouch exactly where he was. Triple bluff. He tracked his gun hand left to right along the theoretical direction she must be moving, waited for the precious lightning. It came sooner than he expected. The storm was ripping in fast. It exploded not more than a half mile away and was followed almost immediately by a bellow of thunder. The flash was brighter than the sun. He squinted ahead. The woman was gone. He jerked left and saw a smudge of vivid blue backtracking away in the opposite direction. He fired instinctively just ahead of it, and the lightning died, and darkness and noise and chaos collapsed around him. 7 left, he smiled. But now I only need one more. The sound of thunder frightened her. It sounded like when Joshua and Billy had put a new roof on the motor barn. They had used big sheets of tin, and they boomed and flexed when they were carrying them, and made a horrible noise when they hammered the nails through. Thunder was like 100 million billion sheets of roofing tin, all flexing and booming in the sky. She ducked her head under the sheets and watched the room light up with bright, wobbling flashes of lightning outside the window. "Are you scared?" the man asked. She nodded under the sheets. It scrubbed her hair, but she was sure the man could see her head moving. "Don't be scared," the man said. "It's only a storm. Big girls aren't scared of storms." She said nothing. He checked his watch again. Her tactics were transparent. She was good, but not good enough to be unreadable. She was working close into the rim of the mesa because it offered an illusion of safety. She was working an in-out-in-in move, double-bluffing, triple-bluffing, aiming to be unpredictable. Smart, but not smart enough. She had moved close and then moved away. Now she would move close again, and then the next time, not away again, but closer still. She figured he would begin to read the pattern and anticipate the yo-yo outward, but she would come inward instead, to wrong-foot him. And because she wanted to be close, she liked close. A headshot artiste like her, he guessed her preferred range would be something less than 10 feet. He jumped out of his crouch and ran as hard as he could, like a sprinter, backward and left, curving around in a fast, wide circle. He crashed through the brush like a panicked animal, big, leaping strides, hurtling mesquite, splashing through puddles, sliding through the mud. He didn't care how much noise he was making. He would be inaudible a yard away. All that mattered was how fast he was. He needed to outflank her before the next lightning bolt. He ran wildly in a big looping curve, and then slowed and skidded and eased in close to the limestone ledge, maybe 20 feet north of where he had first seen her. She had moved south and then back, so now she would be on her way south again. She ought to be 30 feet ahead by now, right in front of him. He walked after her, fast and easy, like he was on a sidewalk somewhere, kept loose, trying to second-guess the rhythm of the lightning step.